In doing interviews for I Remember When, I was surprised to discover that when older Philadelphians' minds turn to the great tragic events of their lives, the influenza pandemic of 1918 holds a special place in their memories. It was, in fact, far and away the worst pandemic of the 20th century, with Philadelphia the hardest hit of all American cities. Yet despite its breadth and severity, it remains curiously neglected. Today's program is going to be about that pandemic.
Welcome, one and all, to I Remember When, Times Gone But Not Forgotten, a series of radio programs on the history of Philadelphia through the memories of those who have lived, loved, and labored in this, the fairest city in the land. Come with us now to the days before antibiotics, when a doctor's house call cost 50 cents and neighborhood women dressed the dead, as we take you back to the fall of 1918 in a program entitled They Were Piling Them in the Street, or Whatever Became of the Influenza Pandemic of 1918.
In the fall of 1918, Clifford was working in a rail yard in West Philadelphia.
Now that influenza came in November 1918, and I was working at this freight station, and I thought I wasn't going to have it. And because I tried to, you know, I thought, well, I was reading the papers and everything, they said keep your bowels moving, going, you know, and don't get constipated, and try to keep from having cold, they wouldn't have flu. So, you know, I caught the flu, and people were dying like flies. And I just didn't make it home. When I got home, I was so sick, and I was living on 31st Street, that street down there, and I went in, and wife said, what are you doing here? I said, I guess the flu has got me. He said, oh, well, so you better go up, go to bed. And I went upstairs. And when the doctor was over, this remedy, he told me to keep taking that. He told my wife and my father, you know, my father wasn't living with, but he went and had to get some whiskey. Take a tablespoon full of whiskey, and about twice as much water, every 2 hours. And that was his main remedy. And that kept, he says, people don't die from the influenza, but they die from the pneumonia that comes on you after you get it, This will keep the pneumonia off you. So that's what happened. But I got to the point where I didn't care whether I died or not. I just felt like that all my life was nothing but when I breathe, I look like it go out by that point and I'd breathe back in, like that, you know. And I wouldn't think about anything. And I just looked like my life was just about like that. And after a while I got feeling better and better until I got up and I went back to work. And I've been here ever since.
Johnny, get your gun, get your gun, get your gun. Take it on the run, on the run, on the run. Hear them calling you and me, everyone for liberty. Hurry right away.
Let's set the stage. Up until the end of September, 1918 had been a good year. It was the final days of the war to end all wars, and the Huns were beating a steady retreat before the American reinforced Allied armies. In Philadelphia, the factories, retooled for wartime production, were running full tilt. In less than a year, a lazy South Philadelphia march had become the Hog Island Shipyard, the largest naval yard in the world. A great symbol of America's industrial might, it was turning out a vessel every 48 hours by the war's end. Throughout the city, wages were good and work so plentiful that some 300,000 people had swelled the city's population. About a third of them, like Clifford, blacks from the South attracted by rumors of good jobs in the city's industries. With news from the front and celebrity hoopla surrounding the latest Liberty Loan drive riveting everyone's attention, a small notice from the Surgeon General's office warning of a spreading influenza epidemic was easy to overlook. In Europe, though, the flu was terribly serious. For the armed forces on both sides of No Man's Land were being devastated by a very lethal new strain of influenza virus, called for no particularly good reason the Spanish flu. On September 11th, it appeared in the Navy Yard, on the 15th at Fort Dix. and then on the 17th, immediately across the Maryland border at Fort Meade. Still no warning was given, as the local authorities believed it could be confined to the military bases. Then October 1st, 1918, the pandemic exploded among the civilian population in Philadelphia. On the 3rd, over 10% of the workers at Hog Island were out sick. And at the end of the first week, 700 people in the city were dead from the flu and its accompanying pneumonia. 2,600 were dead by October 12th, and the death rate was still rising. Though no group was spared, the immigrant neighborhoods were the hardest hit. Anna, then a young woman in her 20s, lived in South Philadelphia.
That was horrible. That was horrible. They died like flies, and we lived near what is the Dariff Division now. It was called the Mount Sinai Hospital. It was just horrible. And my uncle died there. And their son, my aunt and uncle's son, was 13. My father and the Raphael Sachs lived across the street of them on 5th Street, their undertaking establishment that was there then. And because of the neighborliness, they took my aunt died first. They took her to the cemetery, and my father took the 13-year-old boy who also had the flu. He had it was a flu, I guess. And he was wrapped, and my father carried him, wrapped in a blanket to the cemetery because he had to say the prayer for the dead. And came back. And I nursed over there and nursed at home. That time we had a bathtub on the 3rd floor. We carried the hot water up, but we had cold water in the bathtub, and it drained out. We also had an outhouse there. We didn't have any other facilities there.
Yeah.
So anybody who was pregnant and got the flu, they died. They didn't live. And we were young people in 1918. There were a lot of young people who were just married, and they were the first to die, the pregnant women. They died off like flies.
Yes, my son, my oldest son, was born just right there, right in that hand. It was awful. In 1918.
Was that during the flu?
Oh, yes. Oh, it was awful. It was so bad. I remember looking out of the windows. I saw they were just putting coffins on top one of another, and they were taking them out there that way. It was really terrible. Terrible thing. And my doctor came down, and I was in labor for 48 hours, and you know, there was all pushcarts on 7th Street, all pushcarts there. And I lived on a 3rd floor, I had a lovely apartment there, and he slept in that car. He came up like every 15 minutes, you know, when I got into labor, he came in every 15, came up every 15 minutes, and he says, he saw this and he saw that. My mother saw taking out a woman with two babies, she was doing, that were just born. It was a tragedy. I never want to see anything like that.
Did people have ways of dealing with that? I mean, when they didn't really understand?
Didn't understand it. No, they didn't. They were treating them just like anything else. There was nothing they could do for them. Nothing.
It must have been terrifying to give birth as Mildred did while all around you were being stricken sick, many dying. And some of the worst horror stories circulating around the epidemic had to do with the high mortality rate of pregnant women. Stories like the one reported by a nurse who found a young husband dead in the same room where his wife had just given birth to twins. It had been 24 hours since the birth and deaths, the only food within the new mother's reach being an apple. One of the peculiarities of the Spanish influenza was the types of people it struck. Usually the greatest mortality from flu comes along the edges of the demographic spectrum, among the very young and the very old. But this time the groups hardest hit were young men and women between their late teens and early 30s. Apparently the flu had originated in the American Midwest as an epidemic of the grip that passed through in March of 1918. Carried by the American Expeditionary Forces to France, the disease passed from army to army. Now, one of the most problematical features of influenza virus is its ability to perpetually change and adjust to new hosts. In August of 1918, it mutated again, and an epidemic of unprecedented virulence broke out in three continents within the same week. Once again, the armies of the world had been the breeding ground of epidemic disease.
And as I say, my aunt was very sick. She died. My uncle lasted 6 months later. He died the last day of the Jewish holidays. My aunt died the 12th of October, and my uncle died 6 months later.
How long did you all expect this to last? Did you have any idea?
Nobody had any idea. And I never got it.
Yeah.
Never had it.
Yeah.
So.
And the thing I'm wondering is how people reacted. You know, what did people do differently during the epidemic?
They were all afraid. Doctors couldn't come take care of them. And if a doctor came, he prescribed the same medicine for everybody, whatever it was that they gave them. And in our family, there were a number of people in bed, and I was at home during the day and over at my aunt's at night, my uncle's at night.
So what sort of precautions did people take from you? Did people start staying away from each other or not go out into public places?
I really don't know. I know that when we heard of somebody who had died, they died, period.
Right. Yeah. It must have been a terrifying thing to live through.
Well, I guess I was brainless. I'm called brainless, so it didn't really register. I didn't have time. We didn't work. Couldn't go to work.
Why not?
Nobody came in to work. Everybody was sick. And it didn't last too long. I mean, a couple of months, too long. It was a whole lifetime. And the only thing I knew to do was to, whoever had fever, to sponge them. Give them a sponge bath.
Clifford, a teetotaler, took his teaspoon of whiskey. Anna gave sponge baths. She wasn't strong enough to carry her relatives to the bathtub. There just wasn't a whole lot that people could do.
My whole family had it except my mother. And my father, he had it. And the doctor said, well, I can't come every day. He said that I was going to die. Well, I had a bad heart because I had rheumatic fever. He said I was going to die. Just when I die, they should come over and get a death certificate. It would be all right, you know. But I didn't die. And my mother had made good wine out of oranges and lemons and all kind of fruit. And every once in a while, and my father put a blanket around them and he'd get a hatchet and he'd go, well, 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 you know, he was an Indian. And he'd go downstairs. Well, all of us was sick. We couldn't go down, see. Uh-huh. So he'd come up and get in bed, and a little while afterwards he'd do it again, you know.
The medicine dance of Anne's father probably did as much good as any other treatment then available. Remember, in the days before antibiotics and effective vaccines, influenza itself was a killing viral disease. One reason the 1918 pandemic was so devastating was that the flu virus was complicated by a bacterial infection, which led to pneumonia and pleurisy. At military bases where doctors and equipment were available, many soldiers were kept alive by inserting tubes into the ribs to drain off the accumulating fluid. But for most people, there was little that could be done, so they died or pulled through as best they could. The early weeks of October were the worst, with 754 people reported dead on October 16th alone. And as the bodies piled up, the next phase of the crisis grew as coffins ran out and undertakers were overwhelmed with work. Again, the horror stories began to spread. The city coroner's office at 13th and Wood, with space for only 36 bodies, was flooded by hundreds, piled four deep in the halls.
The undertakers just ran, I don't know how many, into their wagon and took them to the cemetery. That was it. And had to dig your own grave. I mean, the families had to dig their own graves. Grave diggers were sick. And it was just all, that was the terrible thing.
It was these sorts of problems in performing the proper rites for the dead that, interestingly enough, affected the survivors most deeply, often even more so than the deaths themselves, and which have stood out also in the memories of those we interviewed. Elizabeth and Anne lived in Kensington in 1918.
They didn't even bury the people.
I used to go to
people. They found them stuck in garages and everything.
Yeah. Oh, it was terrible, the flu.
Yeah. You had to go. My mother went and shaved the men and laid them out, and thinking they would want to be buried, you know. And they wouldn't bury them.
No.
They had so many died that they kept putting them in garages. That garage on Richmond Street, oh my gosh, he had a couple garages full of kids.
Full of bodies.
Bodies, yeah.
Well, on Thompson and Allegheny, Shredder.
Shredder, yeah, he had it too.
He used to get the people and take them out and pile them in the garage. And people smelled something, and they notified him. Jerry, take the people out of the coffin and put them in the garage and get the coffin to somebody else.
Yeah.
And got paid for it. He lost license and all.
Oh, I know.
The smell would knock it run down through the alley. So they caught up with him.
It was terrible.
A lot of people
used
then.
To die. Yes. Oh, they used to die. It was an awful disease.
One of the most moving stories we heard came from Louise in South Philadelphia. She was talking with Tony and Margaret at the time.
I don't remember.
We were the only family saved from the influenza. The rest of the neighbors all were sick. Now, I remember so well, very well, directly across the street from us, a boy about 7, 8 years old died. And they used to just pick you up, wrap you up in a sheet, and put you in a patrol wagon.
Yeah.
So the mother and father screaming, let me get a macaroni box. Before macaroni, any kind of pasta used to come in these wooden boxes.
Yeah.
About this long and that high. The 20 pounds of macaroni fitted in the box. Please, please, let me put them in the macaroni box. Let me put them in the box. Don't take them away like that. And, but that was it. Then, because my mother had given birth to to my younger sister at the time, and then thank God, we survived.
Well,
but they were taking people out and left them right and just
pile
them up, and the undertaker pile up, put them in the patrol wagons and just take them away.
Sad time.
Do you remember the services where they, the masses where they?
Well, the masses now, we weren't allowed to go inside the church.
No, you weren't.
We weren't. The priest would say mass.
Yeah.
Maybe you understand. And we would all be congregated outside. That's
right.
Heard
I remember that.
I don't remember that.
Well, that was a disease.
A kind of the epidemic.
Yeah,
kind of the epidemic.
They figured maybe outside you wouldn't catch the germ as much as if you were in
a closed place.
Well, I remember that now.
I remember that too. We had a friend, excuse me. We had a friend lived on 11th and Carpenter. He had about 6, 7 kids. So this little baby died. Well, about 2 years old, I guess, maybe less. And the undertakers couldn't handle him. They were overpowered at work, you know. And he couldn't get an undertaker to bury his daughter. So he says, if I do get the job, he says, there's nobody to dig the grave. And nobody wanted to dig any graves, you know. He says, I'll dig the grave myself, he says. He says, well, I can't take your job anyhow. So you know what he does? He hired on 4th or 3rd in Bainbridge or 4th in Bainbridge. You go hire a horse and wagon when people used to move.
Yes.
You remember them days?
Yeah.
He went out and hired a horse and wagon for 75 cents. He put his little girl in a box in there, and he went up to the Yaden, up the cemetery over there. He dug the grave, and he put his daughter in his own grave, in that grave. Nobody stopped him.
Would you believe all this?
This is the truth. This is no makeup job.
Can you picture all this?
See how they helped themselves?
Yes, they did, yeah.
They didn't bother.
Well, she wasn't alone. My father went with him and somebody else went with him, you know.
Wasn't City Hall in it or anybody?
Like I said, even those days, like the things were...
While the bodies piled up and people tended the dead as best they could, the city came to a standstill. As Bell Telephone took out ads in the daily papers advising people to refrain from calling except in cases of emergencies, as there was a critical shortage of operators.
Of course, I was going to work, and that looked like a lot of people lived on Spring Garden Street, and you know, the house. It looked like to me about every other house had crepe or whatever they call it to the door, you know, and somebody dead there, and people was talking about it on the bus. Oh, it wasn't buses, it was trolleys. Then.
I heard stories from that epidemic of the bodies being piled out and...
That's
and
right. They stacked up in the cemetery and they couldn't bury them. I was living on 31st Street then. That was a two-way street then, you know. It's one way now. But people would die over this way and had to be buried over this way. You'd have a funeral procession coming this way. And they used to be crossing some, you know, they had to come to this bridge or come one way or the other. And people in there, and I'd be laying there, and they say, they look out the window and say, there's two funeral processions going one way, one going the other way, meeting out there. And that's the way it was. That was a lot of comfort to know you. But I didn't, it didn't worry me. I was taking care of myself. What do I mean? I wasn't thinking about it. I wasn't knowing whether I was going to die or what. I just figured it's gotten in, everything else going on.
This was a real epidemic.
It was.
Yeah, what did people fear the whole city was going to be wiped
well,
out?
Well, they closed all the saloons and they stopped people from going to communicating, you know, coming to churches and different things, and closed the schools and everything, and everything was quiet. And then gradually, after so many died and were buried or stacked up out to be buried, and the weather came on, you know, and all of it, it seemed to get over it. And then you could read about it. It struck Idaho or some other place, you know, and all going on up further up in the northwest and things. And then it went away.
The pandemic peaked on October 16th and then slowly began to leave the city. On the 27th, the ban on church services was lifted, and the next day the schools reopened. Though continued into the winter months, the worst was over. Now, if you look at the city's newspapers during the months of October and November of 1918, you'll find that the epidemic never made the headlines, which were devoted to news from the front and to the end of the war. Later in November, a second wave of the epidemic swept across America, this time mercifully sparing Philadelphia, the city hardest hit in the initial attack. So what was the final toll? Between September 29th and November 2nd, 12,162 people died in Philadelphia of the flu or related pneumonia. And this figure does not include those who died of other causes brought on by the flu. The American Armed Forces lost some 43,000 men, only about 10,000 fewer than those lost in combat. Worldwide, the estimates range from 20 million to 60 million dead. It's possible that as many as 20 million people died on the Indian subcontinent alone. And before giving some final thoughts on the great influenza pandemic of 1918, I'd like to return to Elizabeth and Anna, who also spoke in our conversation about how the dead were cared for when they were young.
What did people do normally in the neighborhood when someone died in the family, either a neighbor or in your own family? How did you take care of them?
And whoever was well would go and take care of them. My mother went... And she laid out people. She'd shave them in and lay them out,
yeah.
You know? Put their clothes on and have them in the casket and everything. They all did that.
And
people did that.
We used to make the meal. We'd take them in.
Yeah.
Even a couple years ago.
Well, you always help people.
Yeah,
my sister had eight girls. She had two boys and they both died. And then... she was put out of her house. Her husband was sick and wasn't working. And my daughter was only a little tiny thing. And she went from house to house collecting, telling people who it was for. And then she was carrying the baby, and the baby died. It was her last boy. And then She told the lady down the street, and this lady bought the whole outfit to lay the baby out. And I went over and laid the baby out. I mean, people used to help each other.
Help another.
Now, nobody even, your neighbors don't come in. Mine don't. Because they're all young neighbors, no. You know. They don't bother.
I used to go into all of them.
Yeah.
Even now, somebody wants something, I'll go in.
Mm-hmm.
So then people on the block, you would...
Yeah.
Neighbors would just come in and help do everything. They didn't have undertakers or doctors come in and do all that.
You had to have an undertaker.
Come, but he wouldn't come enough. He couldn't make enough calls, you know. And he'd say, like he did to my mother, when she dies, come over, I'll give you the death certificate. But the people, they'd have an undertaker. But they'd leave them there so long that they'd say, well, we can't dress them. You know, we don't have the time. So then somebody would dress them, wash them, and clean them up, and shave
and
them.
And then
everything.
Have a big box, like made like a casket. And they used to bring ice in, and like a dishpan, a big one, and they put that over the body. They wouldn't embalm them. Only they lay in the icebox.
Yeah.
And they had a little hole, you could look at them. Dead, you know. And they had that ice and them things. And they, every day, next morning, the undertaker come and throw the ice out and put ice again to keep it cold. The body was cold.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't embalm them or nothing. Just like a coffin, like this table and the lid. And they put that ice, took it like big dish pans, and they put them over the body so they could keep, you know, till it be laid out.
And this is in people's houses during the viewing?
Yeah, in the house. And then they laid them out. We buried them next day. But see, the ice was there. And then then one doctor or undertaker found this here bombing. And then when they embalmed the people, they didn't need that.
Right.
And they used to have, it looked like a big dishpan and stand it in the coffin, and the body was cold.
Yeah. That's what they always said.
Two or three days. Uh-huh. 2 days the
two
most.
2 days the most.
Because she's sitting listening.
Yeah, you know.
She knows.
Now, I included that segment of Elizabeth and Anne talking about how people helped each other and tended the dead because it helps move our account of the influenza epidemic into a larger context. For during times of great duress, the everyday practices and beliefs of a people are often accentuated and placed in bold relief. The first thought that struck me while working on this program, an obvious one but driven home by the first-hand accounts of now rare diseases, was on the swift and great advances made in medicine since 1918. When an influenza virus could paralyze a city and sweep across the world, leaving millions dead in its wake. The disease climate in Philadelphia today is light years away from that of the early 20th century city, when scarlet and rheumatic fever, diphtheria, and a host of other maladies were regular, if unwelcome, guests in the city's homes. The next thought that struck me was how, in the span of only two generations, our knowledge of and experience with sex and death have in a way flip-flopped. As you may have heard in an earlier program on courtship and romance, back in the early days of the century, many girls didn't learn about the facts of life until they were married, or learn about menstruation until they ran bleeding in panic to their mothers. Yet sickness and death were as familiar to them as sexual information was unknown, as relatives not only died but were prepared for burial and viewed in the home. While in recent years sex has gone public, then death is withdrawn and becomes subject to the enormous taboos and injunctions once reserved for sex. Contemporary America's death phobia is one of the more curious and interesting features of our popular culture. The last notion that struck me was about the resilience of people when faced with a real crisis, the remarkable self-sufficiency as they cared for each other, buried their dead, and then went on with business and life as usual. The pandemic passed so quickly that it had little lasting impact on the economics or psychology of the city or the nation. It seems to have been accepted as just another cost of the Great War. But again, scratch any Philadelphian who lived through those years, and they will vividly recall a time, a series of conditions, and an event the likes of which we, with luck, will never witness.
Philadelphia, my hometown, cradle of liberty.
I Remember When, Time's Gone But Not Forgotten is written and produced by Charles Hardy. Funding for this program has been made possible by grants from the Pennsylvania Humanities Council, the Colonial Penn Group, which specializes in promoting insurance, travel, and temporary employment services for America's older persons, the Margaret Doran Strawbridge Foundation, and the Philadelphia Industrial Development Corporation, the firm which helps you relocate, expand, modernize, and finance business in Philadelphia. Contributors to today's program include Clifford Adams, Louise Abruzzese, Mildred Kleeman, Anna Levin, Margaret Oliva, Anthony Lombardo, Anna Van Dyke, and Elizabeth Strupcheski. Interviews contributed by Mark Galicchio and Judy Levin. The engineer was Ron Carson, your host, Charles Hardy.
Where each heart beats through, and they welcome you, thanks for her loyalty.
One of the questions we've been asking people is about just family health care. You were talking about what you did for whooping cough. Did you have a family doctor?
Oh, yes.
50
cents. They used to charge 50 cents to come to the house.
Right. Maybe, and they used to give you medicine, too, sometimes.
Yeah, right. 50 cents.
All the doctors came to the home.
Just honest to God.
They were good doctors. Good family doctors.
I have something in mind I never forget, though. 1918, they had a disease broke here in Philadelphia,
the influenza.
Remember? Yeah. Right? And now, I was the only one well in the family. My brother was laid up with it, my sister was laid up with it, my father and my mother. Just me and my aunt, we took care of the four of them, you know? So one time my mother was off so bad, you know, so my aunt says, go call Dr. Penns. That was Dr. 9th and Federal. So me, I run over to Federal Street. And I was about 11, 12 years old then. Run over to 9th and Federal. I called, Doctor, will you come over? He said, I'll be over soon as I get. I says, all right. So I went home. I says, he'll be right over. So my aunt would say to me, go call Dr. Mamarello, 9th and Catherine. I go and call Dr. Mamarello. So these two doctors, they met. Oh, in the meantime, I went over and called Dr. DeFeo on 11th and Carpenter.
Yeah,
remember
God.
Dr. DeFeo? Wooshy wooshy, he's come around easy, nice and easy, you know,
50
yeah.
50 cents.
In the meantime, the three doctors, the three of them met all at one time we lived on second floor apartment, 10th and Catherine, 10th and Carpenter. And they all met. So they knew each other, the doctors, you know, and they would start talking, you know. And then two doctors ran off into the kitchen, and me, I followed over, you know, and I could hear them talking. He says, that little boy over there, he says, looks like he's got a bad case. He says, oh, he looked terrible, my kid brother then. He was about 7 years old. And so I started to cry, you know, I walked away, and then I went over to my aunt, and I told my aunt about it. He says, I heard the two doctors, Dr. Mamarella, Dr. DeFeo, talking about the Rocky, my brother. He says, he don't think he's gonna. He says, he'll be all right. She's pacifying me, you know. My aunt, now we had an odd house, you know. My aunt, she started to cry. She didn't want to see me. She didn't want me to see her crying.
Yeah.
She went into the hot house, you know, and she banged her head up against the wall, you know.
She felt so bad.
She felt so bad. And she hit a nail. She hit a nail with her head.
Oh, God.
You know what the nail was for, didn't you? We used to get newspapers, cut them in squares. They used to be the toilet tissues.
But we had a metal toilet in the yard.
We used to look for orange wrappers on 9th Street. Remember the orange wrappers?
We graduated.
Then we graduated.
The man used to come with the wagon and sell lemons and
oranges.
They used to be backed up in these tissues. We'd run after them, get the tissues, smooth them out.
That's right.
And then hang them
and
on the nail.
And then stick them on the wall. So my aunt come out bleeding, you know, she was holding her head. What's the matter?
Man.
She said, I bumped into the door, but I see her eyes all puffed up, you know.
Yeah.
So I got a hold of some peroxide, you know, and put it on her head. And I held my cold towel on her.
I'll still go back to those days.
Oh, my God. Yeah, but you've been missing this, what you got today.
Yeah, but we weren't happy as we were then.
Yeah, but there was no crime.
Oh, we were happy
then.
No
crime,
no bitterness, no meanness.
No,
there was
crime.
So much love.
Yeah.
So much respect.
Everybody got
so love. Much family life. What is it today?
Today, family is a beautiful thing.
Where his heart beats true.